Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 333 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about the world of writing and publishing. I'm Valerie Koo, CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre, where you'll find writing courses and a wonderfully supportive writing community. And I'm here with my co-host, Alison Tate, also known as A.L. Tate, author of the popular Mapmaker Chronicles and Adaban Cipher series, and soon to be author of, well, you are already author of, but it's going to be released soon. Author of what, Al?
The Firestar, a Maven and Reeve mystery.
Very exciting.
Dun, dun, dun. If you like my mysterious voice there, I've been practicing.
Yeah,
at
I think
home.
It's good.
I've been doing so much work with regards to, I'm trying to build like resources and we're working on teacher's notes for the book.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, so there's all this stuff. So I'm working on my mysterious voice because I'm thinking I might have to use it a bit coming up.
And of course, Alison finished writing this book quite some time ago, but that's not where it ends, Al, because if you want to make sure that you promote it and you want to make sure that you have additional resources that people are going to be interested in, you have to create these sorts of materials, which is what Alison's doing now. Maybe we should have a podcast episode where we talk a little bit about the kinds of additional materials that are useful. That's probably a good thing for a future episode, isn't it, Al?
Sure, we can do that. Once I've worked out what they're going to be, we can have that conversation. I'm in the process of doing that as we speak. Yep.
Okay. So let us move on to the world of writing and publishing. We have the Australian Writers' Centre blog is going off lately.
I'm loving it.
Yes, big party happening over there. And it's got some fantastic posts over there. And the first one is 5 ways to write your novel while juggling your day job. I really like this.
Well, you know, it's the story. It's pretty much the story of everyone's lives. And you know,
yes,
the interesting thing about
the first novel.
Yes, absolutely. And the interesting thing about the most recent period in our working lives where everyone's been at home, you know, managing kids, trying to, you know, do the day job, you know, via Zoom. And like, let's talk, like, can we just take a moment? How, like, really, the Zoom meeting. Mm-hmm. I know that you don't have to leave home. Mm-hmm. You know, you only have to get dressed from the waist up if you need to. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that stuff is great. You only have to clean the space behind. I had to laugh. There was a fantastic image during the rounds there, which was essentially like somebody doing a Zoom meeting taken from side on, so that you could see that the space behind them was perfectly clear and lovely, and they were, you know, dressed, you know, from the waist up essentially. And then every other corner of the room is just like all this stuff stacked up where they'd moved everything out of the camera. And that's kind of what my life is like these days. I pretty much have to do that. I'm just moving the bits around me to make sure there's a clear space. But yeah, everyone's doing all this stuff and then, you know, trying to write, you know, if they're working on a project or a passion project or whatever, trying to do this writing as well. And it's incredibly difficult to even, because do you know the other thing I noticed too, because one of the things we talk about when we talk about making time to write is using every possible aspect, every little moment of time that you can steal. And one area of time that people have been able to steal in the past or that can steal in normal times is the commute. And the commute has been a big part of many writers, you know, getting their first novel done. Like, I mean, Sue Whiting, who was working as a publisher at Walker Books at the time and writing her novels, she traveled quite a long commute, about an hour, and she wrote her books on the train. You take that commute out, and people don't even have that time. And, you know, it's an interesting thing trying to carve out space for yourself when everyone's at home with you. And this has been my life. I just want to point this out. This has been my life. So, yeah, it's been an interesting time for everyone. And even, like, when you don't have the normal routine of your day, trying to make a new routine for yourself is really difficult.
Yeah, definitely. And Stephen Hart, who is the author of – I might pronounce it wrong, so I'm just going to spell it.
Okay.
C-A-N-T. He's the author of that book. That's what he did in one of his books. I'm not sure about that particular one, but one of his books, he wrote it on his 20-minute – so it's 20 minutes there, 20-minute – 20 minutes back, his 20-minute commute every day, and he wrote an entire novel that way. And it's so true. I mean, obviously it's a little bit different if you drive, but even though I drive, my driving time was my thinking time, was the time that you process those problem-solving things. How do I, you know, write a really good conclusion, or what needs to happen here, or those that that's not expressed quite in the right way. So it's true that that happens. And I kind of missed that. And when I started driving the other day, because I had to go, I don't know, somewhere, a whole heap of ideas that were hanging to come out started busting out, and I had to ring people to write them down.
Oh, you're kidding. So you're driving along ringing people saying, write this down so I don't forget. Write this down. Are you supposed to dictate it to yourself via drag and dictate or something?
But it was like, so hard to coordinate. You're not meant to press your phone with so many buttons, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So it was you can just do it on your steering wheel for the ringing people.
Right. Okay. So your staff must love it. Like, they're just, oh, no, she's in the car. Brace yourselves. It's all happening. But anyway, so let's go back to where we were with the so we're talking about five ways to write your novel while juggling your day job, and there are some great great simple things that you can do that you can start to think about, because I think sometimes with this stuff, when you're sitting in the middle of a day that just looks like there's nothing, like there's no way you're ever going to get this done, you sometimes just need someone to say, well, actually, you do have this time, or actually, have you thought about this, or actually, have you, you know, you done whatever? And then you go, oh, yeah, of course, that's right. Yeah. Just need to be led down the path a little bit.
Definitely. So chances are one of these is going to be helpful to you if you're writing your novel while you have a day job. So the first one, we have talked about this before, but it's one of my favourites actually. And we interviewed Nigel Bartlett, who wrote the fantastic novel King of the Road. And at the time when he was writing that novel, he made sure he carved out every Sunday and said no to every social appointment, and made sure that there was nothing on that day so that he could dedicate it to his book. Since then, he's now in the throes of domestic bliss, and he has other obligations, so he's carving out other time. But
I thought that was quite funny when we were talking about that, because we were talking about that in the podcast community. He was like, "I'm really struggling," and we're like, "Dude, you're the one that put the time aside on a Sunday." Oh, yeah, that's right.
And Joanna Nell, who we've also had on our podcast before, the author of Single Ladies of Jacaranda Retirement Village, The Last Voyage, Mrs. Henry Parker, and her next book is coming out later this year as well. She says to use your time productively. She says that she would be in the car thinking up dialogue at traffic lights. There was a lot of thinking and planning, particularly walking the dog. And one day she walked the dog past my house. Like,
oh, oh.
As I was coming down the driveway.
That would have been very inspiring for her.
I didn't end up in one of her books, though. Or if you can, and I know this one is not necessarily realistic for some people, but that's okay. There are many other tips that you can follow. Try and carve out some time for like a writer's retreat or a little bit of a your own little residency, whether you get an Airbnb or a hotel room in the city or something like that, just somewhere that's different to your normal writings, your normal family environment, so that all of those distractions can go away, as long as you're disciplined, of course, right?
Well, I think the discipline is the key to it. Like the next tip, which is to keep it focused. And Kirsty Manning, the author of The Midsummer Garden, we spoke to her around the time of the launch of that. Mm. She has three children. She lives just out of Melbourne. She still does some freelance work.
She runs a wine bar.
She runs a wine bar. There is that too. And co-owns a great wine store in Melbourne and Sydney. You know, like she's a busy, busy lady. And, you know, she sort of said that she has to, like when she gets those windows of time, those magical windows of time, she has to sit down and get it done. She has to punch it out. There's no coming back to it the next day, because the next day mightn't happen. So I think that the discipline and the habit of teaching yourself to sit, it's like when you do get that moment, to sit down and actually get it done. So you do all of that walking around and thinking and whatever, and then when you get that little window of time, you sit and you write, you do the words. And to me, that is about teaching yourself to have the Pavlovian dog, you know, dog response to sitting at your computer or whatever it is that you choose, wherever you choose to write. So I tend to write pretty much like I'm doing bits and pieces in the car. I'm doing all those sorts of things. But when it comes to actually really making some inroads into my manuscript, I do it at my computer. I'm not someone who does it in cafes. I don't waft about. I sit down and I actually go, right, here I am. This is my computer. This is what I do. I'm a writer. I'm about to write stuff. And I write as much as I can in the time that I have allocated to me. And the only way that you get to the point where your body goes, right, here I am, I'm ready to go, is to actually do it. You have to just keep doing it and doing it and doing it and building yourself a habit. And it's the habit that will get you through when the muse deserts you. I mean, at the end of the day, the muse will desert you. I mean, I'm having this situation at the moment where I'm working on a new manuscript. And, you know, if you've been following my hashtag write a book with Al, you'll know how difficult it's been for me because there's a lot going on sort of behind the scenes in my family life at the moment that I, you know, obviously I'm not going to discuss, but I am finding it very, very difficult to focus on getting these words done. So I'm getting 200 words a day if I'm lucky. But the only reason I'm getting 200 words a day at all is because I have got this overwhelming, overriding habit of just going, right, I need to get this done, right, I need to get this done, I need to get this done. So, you know, they're not the best words I've ever written. They are certainly not the easiest words I have ever written, but I have them.
Exactly.
And at the end of the, you know, this too shall pass, and at the end of it all, I will still have, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 words there that I can't even remember writing, but they're there. And I will be able to then go back and go, either I'm a genius, which, you know, is what we're hoping for, or, oh, my Lord, what was I thinking, and edit, you know, 2,500 of them out of the book. But nonetheless, I will have something to work with. And that's the kind of stuff that I think that's what habit gets you. That's where discipline and a work ethic and the dedication to actually just getting the thing done and the habit will get you through.
And writing in the small spaces, as you just said, because that's also what Heather Rose, who we recently spoke to, she won the ABA award for her novel Bruni. So Bruni's her 8th novel, and she's now able to write she was able to write that full time because she got some grant funding and stuff like that. But her first 7 novels, she wrote around her family and her day job and, you know, life. So she says you have to find that small amount of time where you can sit down and write, well, you've got to use it. You know, I was talking to this woman just a couple of days ago. I know her, and she runs a busy co-working space, and she's there full time. Like, she's literally there at, you know, 9. She leaves at 5. She's there full time. But she also runs a cafe and runs a home delivery donut business. And they're really good donuts. I've had them. And talk about discipline, right, and finding time. She wakes up at 2:30 a.m. every single morning to start making donuts by 3 so that they're all made and then packaged to be dispatched to because they deliver. And then she goes to her cafe and opens it and gets that underway, and then she goes to the co-working space that she manages. So talk about discipline.
When does she go to bed?
7.
Like 5 a.m.? 5 p.m.?
No, because she's still at the co-working space at 5 p.m.
Oh, so she's in bed at 7 o'clock every night.
Or around then, yes.
See? Giving up MasterChef will bring you donuts.
That's right. But that is discipline. Anyway, let's move on to we'll talk about that next week, actually. Al, everyone,
Okay.
Bated breath. We're going to be talking about the next topic. All right. But instead, I'm going to tell you about this fantastic new program that we have called the Teenage Creative Writers Program, and people are already booking in or booking their children in. It is for budding authors, young authors, which will be available very soon. And it's a 10-week course designed for keen young writers to help them unleash their creativity and improve their storytelling skills. If this sounds perfect for a teen, you know, check out the information at writerscentre.com.au/teens. And in fact, you can book in already, and places are limited. So we're thinking about having to hold another cohort so that we can meet demand. writerscentre.com.au/teens. All right. It is Furious Fiction this week. For Woo-hoo! Those of you who want to flex your writing muscles, very exciting. If you don't know, Furious Fiction is this fantastic competition that we hold every month where you can win $500 every month, and you need to write a short story. Entries open at 5 p.m. on the first Friday of every month. You have 55 hours to write no more than 500 words, and entries close at midnight Australian Eastern Standard Time on the Sunday. And yeah, we judge them all, we read them all. There is a
and you
shortlist.
Have so many now. Like it's absolutely extraordinary. If you make the long list or the short list or whatever of this competition, like, the competition is fierce.
It's great fun.
Fierce and furious fiction.
Yes. People are having Furious Fiction parties. Some of them are meeting in pubs. Or they're doing it to on Twitter. They probably weren't meeting in pubs while COVID isolation was going on, but it's going to come back. Yeah. Anyway, if you want to find out more, because there are certain little rules that you need to follow, go to furiousfiction.com.au and make sure that you register your interest so you are emailed directly about what you need to follow at 5 p.m. on Friday, first Friday of every month. furiousfiction.com.au. All right. I really love our giveaway this week. We have 3 Puss Week packs.
Are you serious?
Oh, I love these because I love
Puss Week packs.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen Puss Week, but it is a work of genius.
I have not seen Puss Week.
You have to buy it just because.
You have to be a cat person though. Like
no, it's so clever.
We talked about being cats.
So clever, so unique. It's it's been created by Bexie McFly, who is AWC alumni, and the Puss Week pack contains Puss Week, A Cat's Guide to Feline Empowerment, and Cats Are the Worst. So Puss Week, A Cat's Guide to Feline Empowerment, is full of hilarious spreads, quizzes and advertisements, as well as top-notch photos of cats in all their cuteness and weirdness. Based on the popular series Puss Week by Cats, for Cats, this book is a feline parody of trashy fashion and celebrity gossip rags. It is so clever. Just trust me on this. It's worth
it. I trust you.
If you have a cat lover in your family, buy it for them. If you don't, buy it anyway because it's really funny. It's laugh out loud funny. So also in the pack is Cats Are the Worst. From shredded furniture to messy litter boxes to fur on everything, there are times when every cat owner wants to shout, "Cats are the worst!" This playful book shows what it looks like if the cats could shout back, "No, humans are the worst." Filled with watercolor illustrations that perfectly capture every moment of catitude and packaged in a lovingly clawed case. Seriously, the stuff that Bexie produces on cats on Puss Week is absolutely fantastic. You've got to check it out. So if you want your chance to win one of 3 packs, go to writerscentre.com.au/win. Entries close on the 8th of June. So that's writerscentre.com.au/win. So, Al, after all that excitement, are you ready for the word of the week?
I don't know how you can top Puss Week, but, I'm ready to listen to you give it a whirl.
Okay. Well, I'm not even going to try because Puss Week is that exciting. But the word of the week is sine qua non. Sine,
right.
S-I-N-E, qua, new word, qua, Q-U-A, new word, non, sine qua non.
Of course it is.
So we're getting into Latin this week. Sine qua non is literally translated as without which not, but basically means that something is essential. So you might say determination is a sine qua non of anyone who wants to make it into the Olympic team. Sine qua non.
Discipline is a sine na qua of anyone, qua non of anyone who wants to write a novel.
Yes, true.
See how I did that? Sine qua non. Yep. Okay. That's probably the last time anyone in the whole world will ever hear me say sine qua non.
No, it's not.
Actually, maybe we'll do it. Maybe I'll have a band called that one day or something. Sine qua non.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a song. Anyway.
All right, let's move on. And just a fun fact, because,
fun fact.
Well, what I learnt anyway was because a lot of people will say sign because it's spelled that way, just as a lot of people say veil when they are writing, you know, after someone passes.
Yeah. Right?
But it's vale.
Oh, vale, not vale.
Yeah, so the V's are actually pronounced W.
Oh, thanks for that fun fact.
Fun fact, no worries. All right, let's move on to our writer in residence this week. So we had a cracker of a Facebook Live with Tara Moss recently, and we're bringing that to you here now, the interview with Tara Moss. So it is the audio from the Facebook Live, so you will, you know, hear that I'm taking questions and so on, but hope you enjoy it. I think Tara Moss needs no introduction, but of course her latest book is The Cobra Queen, and we talk about some of her previous books as well in this interview. I am here this morning with Tara Moss. Tara is one of our favorite authors, and I'm so thrilled to be here with Tara having a conversation with her. Obviously, we know Tara as an author, a documentary maker, a presenter, a speaker. She's a very active human rights advocate. She's written a billion books. You know, I've lost count. I don't know. Tara can tell
Maybe
us.
Not quite a billion. I wish I'd written a billion books. That would be very impressive.
So welcome, Tara. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks, Valerie. I really appreciate this. This is my first Facebook Live here from in the mountains where I'm in lockdown. So I'm glad it's working and you can see how kooky our house is here in Australia.
Yes, I want to talk a bit more about that house. But as you can see, there are a bunch of Tara's books above here on the screen, and her latest is the one in the middle, Cobra Queen, The Cobra Queen. I finished it this week and it was a cracker. Now, for people who haven't yet got their copy, just can you tell us what it's about?
Sure. The Cobra Queen is book four in my Pandora English series. It's a long-awaited book. It was 7 years overdue as I was working on other fiction projects. So quite a lag, but the fans kept telling me daily in some cases, certainly several times a week, that they were really keen for the next Pandora English adventure. So I'm so pleased that's just hit shelves now. It's a paranormal universe that I've written in this series, and it's part of my lifelong project as an author to center the stories of women and girls and to kind of shine a light on those characters we don't see as often in fiction. So it's one of four genres I've been writing in. It's the paranormal genre. I also write in crime fiction. I've written a historical recently, and I've also written nonfiction. And really across all four genres, I'm very interested in writing the sort of books that I would enjoy as a reader and maybe wasn't able to find in bookshops, particularly when I was younger. So Pandora really fulfills a lot of that for me. It's focusing on those kind of wonderful folk tales and gothic and horror stories and ghost stories that I loved when I was younger. And it's peopling that universe with a kind of female focus. So Pandora is our heroine. She is the chosen one. She's the seventh daughter of a seventh daughter. She's the one who comes along about every 150 years when the revolution of the dead is coming. And it's up to her to hold back the army of the dead. No pressure. So she has a lot of weight on her mortal shoulders. But she does have a lot of powers that she didn't realize she had as the series began. And one of the joys reading this series and writing it has been the process of discovery for her and the process of discovery for all those other characters as she, you know, as her abilities become clear throughout the books.
Now, I just want to emphasize that even though this is the fourth in the Pandora series, because I read so many books and I always put my hat on to read things as standalone as well, and even though I've read the other Pandora English books, I just want to emphasize to people that if you haven't read the other three, it doesn't matter. This can be, if you have, fantastic. You get to continue on Pandora's journey. But this, in my opinion, is also a standalone book of the Pandora series. Now, the thing is, this book is set in New York, so there are a lot of familiar, you know, locations and iconic places that you refer to and stuff like that. So it's a little bit unusual in that it is a real city that we are familiar with, and yet it is paranormal. So it still needs to be steeped in some level of reality for us to believe that it's And yet it needs to incorporate all this other world. One thing that you're really good at is research. And that's certainly been apparent from your crime novels, from obviously your nonfiction book. What kind of research did you have to do for The Cobra Queen?
So The Cobra Queen, as with all of the Pandora English series, involves a lot of historical research. So I really love to delve into mythology. In this series, there's also ancient mythology, Egyptian mythology, but also regular kind of folk tales and beliefs from different cultures feature in each of the Pandora novels. As you said, the series is set in New York, but it's an alternate New York where there's a very thin veil between the living and the dead. And our main character, Pandora, sees ghosts. But in some instances, those ghosts are the ghosts of real people with historical, interesting historical stories. So some of that research is in The Cobra Queen, but most of it was really centered on the Egyptian themes in this book, and also a particular location that I love, which is the Met Museum. The Met Museum has the wonderful Temple of Dendur, which is a very famous Egyptian temple that was moved over there. I believe it was in the 70s or the late 60s. There's a picture of me researching at the Temple of Dendur at the Met last year when I was in New York doing research for The Cobra Queen. And just being able to be on the ground at a location you're writing about, I think, is incredibly important. As you mentioned, there are a lot of fictional locations in this series, but really the rest of the book is very much steeped in actual fact and in places and in things that you can tangibly either research or actually experience. I could do a Pandora English tour of New York, for example. Yes. We go just about everywhere that, you know, everywhere that mortals could go anyway. Under the supernatural mist of Spectre, but we would be able to walk down those other streets. We'd be able to go into Soho, where the fictional Pandora magazine offices are. We would be able to go up the Empire State Building, and we would go here to the Met Museum in New York and see all of the exhibits for Hatshepsut, the pharaoh, which is the focus of this particular novel, and also the Temple of Dendur, which features in a couple of pretty key scenes in this novel.
Right. So, and just so people know, Pandora, yeah, it works at a fashion magazine in New York. It's a really cool setting. Now, on this, as you mentioned, there is this temple here, and this is a picture of you at the Met Museum, and there are references to ancient history in Egypt. So just on a practical level, you go to the Met in this picture, right?
Yeah.
How much time did you spend there? What did you do at the Temple of Dendur? What kind of notes did you want to write at the time? Did you already know what was going to happen in the book at this setting, or did you go to this setting and thought, oh, we'll put it in the book, you know?
I knew that I wanted to set the book around the Met Museum. It was one of the reasons for the focus in this particular book on ancient Egypt. That along with Pandora's history, which without giving too much away to readers who aren't familiar with the series, Egypt does feature, and Pandora's late mother was an archaeologist. So we already have that connection with Egypt. And when you think about Egypt and you think about New York, well, that leads you straight to the Met Museum, because really they're quite famous for their Egyptian collection and the incredible number of exhibits they have there. Hatshepsut in particular, who's a focus in this, is a real life historical figure. She was a princess who became a king, and quite a number of her of monuments from her reign in ancient Egypt actually are at the Met Museum. So I knew that I wanted to set this book at the Met, not fully, but with those key scenes. I knew that before I did research specifically for the Met. I've been to the Met before. I've been to New York many times, and throughout this series, I've researched in New York many times. So it wasn't my first time at the Met. And I wrote the scenes pretty rough scenes, rough drafts, but actually they were pretty specific already by the time I was writing those scenes set at the Met. And so my research trip there was almost, it was like a confirmation to make sure that I got all the details right, and to also allow myself to be inspired by any things that maybe I hadn't thought of since the last time I was there. So it was a bit of a refresher, a confirmation, and also a kind of an inspiration session to go back and do research while I was in the throes of the deadline for the Cobra Queen. But it wasn't my first time there, and it wasn't my first bit of research at the Met. Thankfully, a lot of locations do have a fair bit of information available for us online now. With the Met Museum, I was able to access a lot of digital files and information through my research. The Met Museum is often very helpful with that as well, because they are a big institution and they're used to researchers wanting to contact them. So they're pretty good in terms of being contact for research. And then when I was there, it was just kind of like, it was like the dream of walking into my own novel and the scenes I had already written. And I would, I brought a notepad and pen. I also sometimes use like iPhone notes. So sometimes those are quicker. And I took a lot of photographs, of course, just to refresh for me the placement of the different exhibits and monuments. And again, any other thoughts that came to me while I was walking through those sections. I admit, I didn't even go into the other parts of the museum. I went into the gift shop and got Horace here. I reached for the wrong side because of the mirror effect of the camera. But I got Horace here as an enamel pin, and also bought this pin, which I'm auctioning off at the moment with a series of the novels for charity. But apart from running in and grabbing those from the gift shop, I spent all my time in the Egyptian section, literally until they closed and kicked me out. And it was, you know, a beautiful experience when you're a writer and you've been writing about a place for months and months to actually walk into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I just want to acknowledge everyone who's come from all over Australia, from, you know, WA. Hello, Bob, Nicole, Bobby, hello. Danuka, Melanie, Ray, Colleen, Belinda, countless people, Felicia, lots and lots of people. Thank you for joining us. We will get to your questions soon. So apart from the Met, for this book, what other places did you have to research fairly in depth, or were you pretty clued up about New York and stuff?
I was pretty clued up about New York. I enjoyed going up the Empire State Building again. There are some scenes set at the Empire State Building throughout the series, because obviously if you're going to set a series on Manhattan Island, how could you possibly leave out the Empire State Building? The other fun spot that I got to visit was the Statue of Liberty. So Lady Liberty, that colossal statue, features in this book as well, and is a pretty wonderful place to visit. So I always think, as an author, and this is my 21st year as a published writer, write what you know or what you want to know, and also write about where you want to be, because you're going to have an excuse to go there as part of your research. And I've been quite fortunate to be able to write about things that I really find very compelling and interesting. And writing about New York, well, who doesn't want to go there and do that research? There's no part of New York that's really not exciting to me. It's all wonderful. And I guess for me, I'm almost writing about myself as Pandora in that respect, because she is quite dazzled by the city of New York as well. You put up a great picture there from the Evolution store in New York.
And it looks like your house.
As you'll see, there's a pretty strong relationship between my living environment and my writing and the worlds I create in fiction. The Evolution store in New York is a real place. It features in the series. It is next to the fictional offices of Pandora magazine, the fashion magazine Pandora works for, which is coincidentally a magazine with the same name as Pandora. She likes to use that. She likes to work that to her advantage from time to time. But a few people were quite surprised after my last trip that actually it is a real place. You can visit it. It's gonna do something here and share this fabulous interview we're doing so other people can come and say hello.
Oh, for sure. Well, while you're doing that, I just want to acknowledge Sandy and Susan and Chris and Belinda and Moira has said, Tara, you're such an inspiration. Hello from Ballarat. So many people, yeah. But, what is in this store? I mean, it's a bit hard to see in the photo, but tell us a bit more about what you researched in this store.
So I actually lived in New York when I was working as a fashion model back in the 90s, and I've always been fascinated by the city. This is undoubtedly my favorite store in New York. It is filled with, as you can see, filled with skeletons, skulls, anatomical items from different cultures and with a kind of a theme of mortality, I guess is one way you could put it. They have Venus flytrap plants. They have, most of them are like skulls that are made of other materials. You can't actually, as I mentioned actually in the book, you can't buy human remains. There's laws against that clearly, but they do have some which have been used for medical models. And there is a medical model skeleton, full skeleton, that is outside of the Evolution store. It features in the book in several points throughout the series. It's always sort of on the street, either like holding a sale sign or just standing there kind of blowing in the breeze with all the jangling joints and bones. But that that skeleton really struck me before I even wrote this Pandora English series. So I have a lot of fun when I go back to New York visiting the Evolution store every time. They're big fans of Pandora English now there because they've come to read the series themselves. And I'm just a big fan of this. You can actually sign up for their newsletter. So you can go to the Evolution store online. By the way, this is an unpaid unpaid advertisement. I'm just a fan. And I like to write real places into my books wherever it's possible. And I've done that with Evolution. And they didn't know I was writing about their store until many years into the series. But now I've gone in there and spoken with them about it. And they're big fans of Pandora. And it is it's appropriate to the series. It's appropriate to the themes in Pandora's world. And it does make us think about those kind of ethical questions to do with human remains and what happens after we die. And also in the context of something like the Evolution story, you know, there are specimens there that are real specimens that they're legally allowed to have from purchases in the past. And at the Met Museum, there's real human remains as well in the case of the mummies. And one of the things the Cobra Queen makes us think about as a novel is sort of the ethics of that, like what happens to our remains after we die and who has the right to put those on display and how all that works. I don't make any prescriptive suggestions as to what I think should happen, but I think it's a conversation that's worth discussing and exploring. And I do that through the Pandora series as well.
Mm. When you're writing a series above it,
you guys can see my skull mug here. Let's just say that the themes go deep here in the Moss household. So.
When you're writing a series, and certainly when you're writing about an alternate world, things need to make sense. They need to be consistent. It's harder to remember because it's not the real world. So you don't remember necessarily that that's meant to go there. Some authors work with a series Bible of some nature. Do you do that, or do you have an equivalent of that?
I do have a series Bible. It is constantly being updated, but I have to confess I'm not one of those authors who's particularly methodical about my note-taking. Most of it is up here, and that's true even for a series that's been going on for years. So I sometimes do find myself caught out where I'm working on a pretty solid draft of a book, and then I realize someone's grown by 2 inches, or their eye color has changed from green to blue, or something like that, that, you know, I should have caught but haven't caught yet. The fans will certainly catch, and I hope the editor at the publishing house will catch. There's sometimes, you know, stoppers in place for that stuff to not make it through to publication, but very often it is on the author. You do need to be responsible for your own work and all of those details. And if you don't catch it, there's a chance someone else will not catch it as well. So that's the reason I keep a Bible. I will often also keep photographs of people who are the inspiration for particular characters. So I might print off an image of a character from it. Actually, I won't give away who it was, because then you'll be just thinking of them when you think of the characters in the book. But I'll print off a picture of someone that is, physically speaking, an inspiration for the aesthetics of that character. And then what I might do is write little notes beside it, and I will keep it on the wall where I'm writing, and it will be part of my writing inspiration material as a novelist on that particular project. But certainly because there's been a gap with the Pandora novels, I went back, I started listening to the audiobook versions, which are all through Belinda Audio, while I was going for walks. And I reread the physical books as well, and took notes and kind of refreshed myself with the Bible and other aspects of the series, because there had been this gap when I was working on producing documentaries and working on writing nonfiction and academic study. And of course, that, you know, there's only so much you can kind of keep in your brain at any one time. And I felt pretty overloaded with all that stuff. So once I was able to kind of commit to sitting down and writing the books, continuing writing the books, and I had a publisher to support me through that, it was pretty fun to dive back into Pandora's world.
So I'm going to bring in this question from Melanie, which kind of relates to this, which is, when you start a series, do you have an end in mind from the start, or do you let it evolve and see where it goes? And I guess tied into that, when you did the first Pandora novel, had you imagined it was this series, you know?
Look, there's a sort of sliding scale, I think, when it comes to authors. Some of us plan everything when we start, down to the point where there are really detailed outlines of every chapter. Then there's the fly by the seat of your pants type author. I wear a lot of dresses, so I don't know, fly by the seams of my dress, okay? So between these two polar opposites, I'm probably just like leaning towards the flying by the seams of my dress, okay? But I am also a very big planner. As you mentioned before, I'm a big researcher. So what I will tend to do is immerse myself completely in the world I plan to write. I will research it quite extensively, and usually for years before I start to, you know, actually write the series I'm intending to write. But then what I find is during the writing process itself, that's when I start to head this direction, because the experience of writing means that those characters start to take on their own lives. They start to tell me what they're going to do, and I have to adapt and keep up. And that's how, really, by the end, I'd say between those two poles, I lean this direction. I'm not all the way over here, because I plan a lot. I'll plan out a lot of the elements of the book. I'll plot, I will research, I'll plan. And then what I find is, like, I'm never over here, even if I intend to be. And I think life would be so much easier if I could just decide what I'm going to do before I do it. In reality, the characters often decide a lot of it for me. Now, with the Pandora English series, I see the wonderful Melanie here. She also is the one who is in the lead so far, bidding on this auction item for charity, actually. So
wow.
Thank you, Melanie, for your
and we'll share details of that soon.
Yeah, she's just, yes. So thank you, Melanie, you've been incredibly generous. But just speaking back to your question, obviously with the Pandora English series, there's this big climax with the revolution of the dead, and that was mentioned in the very first book. So there are elements that have been solid throughout the process of writing and the evolution of the characters. But to my mind, if I know everything that I'm going to write before I write it, it's almost not worth writing. For me, there is a process of discovery, which is part of my motivation for being an author and part of the joy that I find in the writing process. So I would never give up that uncertainty and exploration and discovery. For me, that's really perhaps going back to Pandora's mom, the archaeologist. It's that digging away and finding the story that I find a real joy. If I know everything that's hidden already, it kind of takes some of the joy away from me.
So when you're actually in the throes of writing your first draft, you know, you can take this book, for example, or the book that you're currently in the midst of, what a certain amount of discipline is required to get an entire novel out of you. So how do you structure your writing practice so that you meet the deadline, so that, do you achieve a certain number of words per day, or do you reward yourself with Tim Tams? I don't know. You know, what's it look like?
You've been spying on me, Valerie. You know about the Tim Tams. How do you know about the Tim Tams? There's a few things there. Because it's been 23 years of writing and 21 years of being published, I've tried a lot of things. I have experienced writer's block before. I've had books that have taken a lot longer than other books. I've had books that were a lot easier than other books. So constantly through the last couple of decades, I've been trying to hone my craft and practice as a writer. I'm always compelled and motivated to write, but the end result, and especially the timeline of the writing process, can vary a lot. So what I've tried to do in the past is to set a number of words per day that is my goal. I set that at 1,000 words a day. Whatever software you're using, I use a lot of like your classic Word doc, really basic stuff. You can check your word count all the time and have a really good sense of where you are for the day. More recently, I came across Scrivener. I've been using Scrivener a bit for the long form projects. And you can even work on Word doc and then start sticking it into Scrivener if you want. And Scrivener allows you to keep track of your deadlines as well. I'm really pretty bare bones basic, though. I don't like a lot of the bells and whistles. I just want a place for my story to live while I'm writing it, whether that's Word or Scrivener, I don't care, as long as I can keep track of those basic elements. The trick with 1,000 words a day is that some days I might sit down and write for 9 hours and get next to nothing. I'm frustrated. I feel like I'm getting blood from a stone. It's not flowing. So I think it's also important to put a cap on the hours, because you might be trying to get that 1,000 words and just about tie yourself in knots. It's just not working. So some days I aim for 1,000 and I get 100. Some days I aim for 1,000, I get 3,000. The important thing, I think, is to constantly try every working day that you intend to write. I think it's actually a good idea to try to write every day if you can. But clearly, you're not going to be able to do a full work day every single day of the week through your whole novel project. That's unrealistic. So decide what days of the week you're going to write. Decide how many words is your goal, but be open to writing more than that. And also accept it if you write less. Like, that's just the reality of being a novelist. I've been doing this for a long time. You just have to trust me and kind of any other professional writer out there. There are days where you absolutely intend to write that 1,000 words and you're not going to make it. That's okay. If you write 100 words a day and you do it every day, eventually you'll have a book as well. So don't try not to be too hard on yourself. The reality is that I never write like 1,000 words a day until I've hit my 100,000 words. That would mean it took me only like 3.5 months to write a book. It never takes 3.5 months. Never once has it ever taken me 3.5 months. But I think that setting a word goal is really good. If you hit that 1,000 words, you can think, okay, I'm tired now, I'm going to put the computer away and just walk away, take a break. But be open to and flexible about what is actually happening in the real world. With COVID-19 and lockdown, for example, I'm way behind on my writing. I have a writing document open for a novel that's due later this year. It's sitting there. I'm totally committed, but I have not been able to work on that document for weeks because the world changed very suddenly. I had to change countries. You know, our house is being packed up, or not our house, our condo in Vancouver is being packed up as we speak by movers, by people we've never met before, because everything changed and we suddenly found ourselves on the other side of the world. So stuff happens, life gets in the way, but if writing means a lot to you, try to make the time wherever you're able to, and try not to be too hard on yourself when you don't hit those goals.
And of course, the important question about the reward.
Oh, the obviously, there are some downsides to rewarding yourself with food every time you do well, but I admit that I do tend to do that. I like it. I like a snack. I like my coffee, which is what is inside this dark skull mug presently. I don't know that if I could write a book without coffee. For some people, it's tea. For Great Aunt Celia, it's her magical tea that gets her through. So whatever gets you through, as long as you're not hurting yourself, go for it. I actually find that some of the best inspiration comes when I take a break and go for a walk. Yes, it can come with that second or third cup of coffee. Put a cap on that, because eventually you won't be able to sleep at night if you're keep caffeinating through the day. But sometimes it's actually a walk that's going to help you, or listening to an audiobook while you're exercising or stretching, watching a movie, some other treat. So just find something that you enjoy where your need to write is not front and center. Put that aside for a little bit. And I actually find that often does allow the freedom for the creative process to kick in, because your subconscious, certainly in my case, it's my subconscious that writes a lot of the books. I do all the planning. I have all my intentions and ideas and plots and all that research. But ultimately, when I get into it, my subconscious is connecting a lot of the dots for me. And you need to be able to give yourself the mental space for that particular element, a writer, to kick in. If you're squeezing yourself too hard and pushing yourself too hard, I feel that actually you're really getting in the way of your own creativity. So it's always a balance. I don't have a magic formula for you to share. If you have one for me, please. Magic formula is, because I haven't worked it out.
If you have the magic formula, put it in the comments. And just a reminder, I know that there are a bunch of people who are asking questions, but we can't see them properly unless you click on the link above the video. So do that. But one we can see properly, which is an interesting question from Jacinta, is because you're saying you're working on a book at the moment and you work across multiple genres. And I want to talk about that a bit more in a sec too. But Jacinta said, how do you plan which book is the next one you're working on, especially when you have a few different series? Well, and genres that you've been working on?
That's a good question. Sometimes that's taken out of my hands. So I am a full-time professional writer. It's not a hobby for me. It's something that I need to be able to pay the bills so my family can eat and so I can eat and pay my medical bills and the mortgage and all that stuff. So it is a real job for me. It doesn't make my writing more important for someone than someone who isn't being paid for their work. And certainly at the beginning, I wasn't paid for my work. But now, 20 odd years in, this is my profession. So if I don't have a publisher, or I don't have any prospect of a publisher for a series, obviously the amount of time I can commit to it is going to be pretty limited. I always present my ideas to the publishers and then get a book deal or don't, you know. But when I have that commitment from a publisher about an idea put forward and they've given me a deadline, well, that's going to be the book that I work on next. So I do have a 3-book deal for the Billy Walker series. The first in those books was called Dead Man Switch here in Australia. It's The War Widow overseas. And I'm working on the second in that series. So that's set in 1946. It's a kind of, it's a noir kind of golden era of PI fiction, if you will, a hard-boiled series with, again, central, strong, kick-ass women in it. Billy Walker is the central character here, and she's been described as a fast-talking, fast-driving, champagne-swilling Nazi hunter. So she's pretty incredible, and I'm writing about her at the moment. But like I said, there's been a big lag because life got in the way. Nonetheless, I'm writing her. I have a deadline in December, and I have publishers in Australia, the US, Canada, Germany, and Romania waiting for that book. So that's, you know, that's the kind of thing where I go, well, I have to commit my time to this, and I have to think about it almost like a 9-to-5 job, even though my hours might not really be 9-to-5. For other books like the next one in the Pandora English series, which I'm really very keen to write, I have to wait until I know that I can get that published. And that is really dependent on the support of the fans and how the book does. Like, if people are still enjoying this series and they're supporting it, that gives us the opportunity to publish another book. But if no one buys the book, then a publishing house can't afford to support that book and get it out there. And I can't afford to take the time to write it, because I'm going to need to do something to pay the bills. So I'd love to tell you that being a best-selling author means that all bets are off. Everything is, you can write whatever you want, and I can sleep in until whenever I want. But it is a job as well as being my passion. And I guess that makes me one of the very lucky people who gets to do what they love for a living. But I do need it to still be for a living. So often it is not me who decides which book I'm working on next. Often it's the support I get from publishers. And I'm pitching books, you know, not all the time, but anytime I have an idea that I'm really focused on, I'll hone that for months, I'll put it together, I'll pitch it. And if I get that support from publishers, fantastic. I'm in, and that's going to be years of my life to come. And that's the case with Billy, and I hope that will be the case again with Pandora as well.
Let's circle back to, you said a little while ago, oh, I wish it would only take me 3.5 months to write a book. So can you give us an indication, in reality, how long generally is the gestation period for one of your novels?
That's a very good question, Valerie. I'm not a book a year author. I've never been a book a year the author. I think I've pulled it off a couple of times just by the coincidence of the publication dates, but not the actual writing process. I would say it takes about a year and a half for me to complete a novel. So as you can see, that's a very different time period than, 100 days of writing 1,000 words a day. In reality, even if you were to do 1,000 words a day for 100 days, which would be amazing, go for it. If you can do it, do it. You still then have to edit your work. You still then have to hone it. And before that, you have to have researched, plotted, and planned. So any way you look at it, it's going to take quite a lot of time. For me, I find the average is about a year and a half. And that's from the time that I already know what I want to write and I've pitched it and had it accepted, and have now just started writing it. That's usually about a year and a half to the time that I submit it back to the publisher. So there's a lot of time there in the researching and plotting, in the writing process itself, and the editing, which I do myself. Then it goes to a publisher, and you have the editorial process with that publisher before it goes to print. So hopefully that gives you guys a pretty good idea. There have been books that have taken a little less time than that, and there's been books that have taken a lot more time than that, like the Billy Walker book, Dead Man Switch, or The War Widow took over 2 years. And there was research for ages before I even started that process. So some books take a lot longer than others.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about, research, because I really do think you get into that. And I think that to some of these images, the one on the left is you at the FBI Academy at Quantico.
With terrible blonde hair. Why did I done that? I don't understand. This, by the way, is my natural salt and pepper, and it's all shiny. And look at that fried blonde hair. Anyway, okay, please go on.
And the other photo, obviously, is you shooting a, I don't even know what kind, you tell me what kind of
I think there's an AK-47 back. That's with the SWAT team in Los Angeles. I might be getting the type of gun wrong, but that's from memory. It was a few years ago. So I've done a lot of research with different weapons, and particularly weapons that characters in my books are using. So I'm not licensed to have a firearm. I don't ever want to be. I don't like the idea of having a gun in my home, but I have characters who use guns, particularly who are in law enforcement or who kick a lot of butt in a pretty violent world, like Mac Vandewall from my crime series. So I've done a lot of research to make sure that I'm writing her character as authentically as possible.
So people would say, I know that people are saying, how do you get to go to Quantico? How do you get to say, hey, SWAT team in LA, let me shoot an AK-47 with you?
That's a really good question. If you get good at research, or if you're an investigative journalist, you will know that you have to work pretty hard to get access, and it takes a long time. There's no online form you can fill out to get access to the Academy at Quantico. It takes a lot of time, and it also takes research contacts. So over the last couple of decades, I've built up trust with a number of professionals who are in law enforcement, who are in international relations with the sorts of people I do this research with, whether it's FBI agents, whether it's police officers, whether it's people who are on SWAT teams. And through my humanitarian work, there's a bit of crossover as well. And it takes time to build up the trust with those contacts. And that's how you eventually do get access. That and a lot of police checks and, you know, a lot of rejection. But going to Quantico is certainly one of the highlights of my research experiences. I used to call myself a kind of forensic tourist. So I've been to morgues, I've seen autopsies, I've gone to crime scenes, I've gone to the FBI, I've shot guns with the LAPD, I've been set on fire, I've been choked unconscious, I've done loops over the Sydney Opera House.
Hang on, just slow down here. Hello, you've been. Yeah. Like, can you?
I've done a few things.
Let's dig into a couple of things that you said there. I've been set on fire and I've been choked unconscious. Can you just expand on both of those things?
And but not in what at the environment? Same time. Okay. But not at the same time, which I think is an important element. So my character, Mac Vandewall, in my crime series I wrote for years, she was my first fictional character, and I love Mac. She got choked unconscious at one point in one of the novels, and so I felt that I needed to go through that experience so I could write it authentically. I went to an expert who was Big John McCarthy. He's a fighter, an extreme fighter. He does wrestling, and he teaches, I'm trying to, what, ultimate fighter is the word I'm looking for. He's an ultimate fighter. He's also really very large, from memory, about 6'7", and I'm just a bit over 6 foot. So I actually needed to have that dynamic of a person choking me out who's bigger than me, because Mac also, as a character, is tall like me, but was faced with a foe who was very, very large. So Big John McCarthy fit the bill in all respects. He teaches the Los Angeles Police Department in hand-to-hand combat, or had at that time. And so I went to Los Angeles and he choked me out on request. We did it as safely as possible. I learned and researched as much as possible beforehand. We had checks in place. And can I just say, folks, do not try this at home. Don't do it. It's dangerous. It's cutting off blood supply to your brain. Not something to be done lightly. But it is something that's done quite frequently in wrestling. Or, as I said, in a certain context in law enforcement, when you need to. And so I went through that. And it did give me some insight. It kicked in my fight or flight response. So the autonomic nervous system kicks in a situation like that, assuming that you're in danger, which you are, because the blood supply has been cut off to your brain. And before I passed out, there's actually video footage of this. Before I passed out, I was in this sort of twilight state between being conscious and unconscious. And just like in wrestling, professional wrestling, we were going to have me tap out if I wanted to stop. But I'd flown to Los Angeles. I'd got Big John McCarthy. Obviously, I was not going to tap out. I'm like, I'm committed. I'm doing this thing. And as I started to go unconscious, my body was like, this is bad. You not need to not do this. And I was sort of almost tapping out, but wasn't, because my brain was like, you're not going to tap out. And there was this sort of zombie effect where my hands were going out like this just before I became unconscious. And when I woke up, I had no idea how much time had passed. It had only been a few seconds. That's the safest way to do this thing that is unsafe and that you shouldn't do. Just a few seconds, but it was impossible to tell how much time had passed. And my body was filled with adrenaline because of that fight or flight, the adrenaline that your body gives you in order to get out of a dangerous situation. So it gave me a lot of insight into that experience, and I was able to write about it for the Mac series.
And of course, Mac is a much loved character. I was talking to my partner last night, and his first question was, are you going to ask her about Mac? I'm like, anyway. So we're going to have time for a couple more questions. If you have them, make sure that you put them in the comments. Remember that I can't answer them. We can't answer them if you don't have not clicked on the link above. But and I can't promise that we get to them all, but we will try. Now you have your private investigator certificate 3 of private investigator credentials from the Australian Security Academy. Are you A, moonlighting as a private investigator, or B, what did you learn from that course, I guess, that you've then incorporated in your A, books, B, life?
Okay. There's a question in several parts. Well, if my novel Tank, you'll see me listed in the phone book and you know who you can call if you need something done, Valerie. I do have private investigator credentials. I got those because I was writing about a character that is a private investigator. Interestingly, writing about Billy Walker in Dead Man Switch and The War Widow, she's a private investigator, but she's an investigator in 1946 before you needed to have a certificate 3. She didn't actually require the investigators at the time did not require special certification. In fact, they could have a long criminal record to their name and still operate as a private investigator. Now, things have changed a little bit and you have to get a certificate 3. So I got that. I'm not licensed in the sense that you can't call me up and have me do a job. that the only reason I'm not licensed is just the money it takes to maintain your license. Because I'm just an author, but I could certainly get myself licensed and start operating if I wish to, and hopefully my novels will continue to go well and I won't need to do that work. It's pretty fascinating, though. I learned a lot. I went out with private investigators on jobs as well, including on some domestics, which was pretty odd as an experience because you are tailing someone when they're unaware that you're following them. I mean, that's part of the job of being a private investigator. But I'm the type of person where I feel kind of uncomfortable, like following someone around with them not being aware that I'm there. But it put me into the world of being a PI. I learned a lot of things. I learned about the law. I learned about the private investigation methods. I learned about what my character would do to solve a case. So it was quite valuable in terms of the research. It took a lot of time, sure, but it was like all the other things I've been doing, getting my race car driver's license and my wildlife handling license and all the other licenses. I get these because I'm really genuinely interested in life. I can't seem to get enough of licenses and certification because there's so much to learn in the world. There's just not enough time. Learning about the work of private investigators, I think, is pretty important when you're writing about one.
Ray has a question, which I think is a great one. What would be the most incriminating search that you've done on Google if the police seized your computer and didn't know you were a writer? Take it away.
That is a great question, Ray. So prior to the world of Google doing research, I used to have an incredibly alarming library. I still own those books, but I don't kind of have them at hand all the time. An alarming library of the black arts of death, homicide investigation manuals. And these are complete with graphic crime scenes in them. They're the books that real investigators use, and I have all of those, which I'll not show you because it's really not very nice material to look at unless you have a reason. But I used to think, you know, when the telephone company, when some guy comes over to fix something, that he would see this and just run, and the door would be hanging open as they ran for it, wondering what kind of person's house they've walked into. My Google searches can be pretty alarming. I think cannibalism features, you know, how embalming works features. There's all kinds of odd stuff that I look up. I don't know that I could in all reality describe the worst and most incriminating Google search that I've done recently, but there would be a lot of them. And to do with poisons and the effect of poisons and how long it takes and what happens to a person when you poison them. I mean, these are the sorts of things that don't look great in your Google search record. So what can I say? I'm an author, folks. You just have to believe me. All good reasons.
All right. We have a good question from Leanne. How and when did you start writing across genres? And in particularly, what drove the decision to change directions? Do you have a preferred genre to write in and also to read?
This is a great question, Leanne. I understand that I'm unusual in that I write across genres. Not that many authors feel that they want to do this. The term change directions, I don't think is quite right, just in the sense that I'm expanding rather than changing. So I've been writing Pandora and been fascinated with the paranormal since I was a kid. So writing in this genre after the other ones, like, it's not different for me. It's just an expansion. It's four genres I've written in so far. I guess I don't really think about storytelling in terms of categorization. I think of the story and what I want to achieve, and whatever genre that is, I'll go for it. So I read quite widely myself. I read in the paranormal genre. I read sci-fi, which I've never written in. I read nonfiction. I read poetry, which I'm no good at. I read in a lot of different genres. And whenever I feel that I have a story to tell or something to achieve by writing in a particular genre, I will go for it. I'll do my best at that genre. And so far that's been crime fiction, paranormal fiction, historical fiction, and nonfiction. The first big jump, I guess, was when I put out The Fictional Woman, the first of my two nonfiction books that I have out so far. A lot of people called this like a big switch to nonfiction. I was doing a lot of academic study at the time. I also felt that it was maybe time for me to introduce myself a little more intimately to my readers and the public. I had turned 40 that year, and I felt that I had some nonfiction things to say, some nonfiction discussions to have. And I really focused on that for a few years there before I put out my historical fiction book and the next Pandora. It doesn't mean I won't write nonfiction again. In fact, I'm sure that I will, but I need to find that project and moment for that to be the next thing I focus on. Every time I focus on a book or a genre, it's years of my life. So I have to be 100% committed and compelled to focus on it and to write about it. But returning to Pandora has been just amazing. And that process has now been a 10-year process. I've lived with Pandora for a decade now, with the first one, The Blood Countess, having come out in 2010. So I don't really change direction. I just expand the areas that I'm working in. And I will undoubtedly write more crime fiction, more nonfiction, more paranormal, and who knows, maybe even other genres when I feel compelled to. And it's because I love all of these genres. Like, for me, they're part of my experience as a reader. With Pandora, it's also part of my childhood, because these were the sort of books I wish I could have read when I was younger as well. They're for all age groups, really, but I could have read this at age 11 or 12 and just like gobbled it up. And I think maybe even seeing the world a little bit differently than the way I did at the time, because all of the paranormal heroes that I was reading about were exactly that, heroes and not heroines. They were all, you know, the chosen one is always Harry Potter, or it's always, you know, the male figure, and not, it's the seventh son of a seventh son and not a seventh daughter. So I wish these books were available for me when I was younger, and I'll continue to write books that center the stories that I haven't seen focused on enough.
Yeah, there's some wonderful underlying feminism in these books. So on the screen we have the four books in the Pandora English series, including the latest one, The Cobra Queen. And also, well, tell us about this package that you've got here and what's going on. And I've also got the link at the bottom of the page. That's the Pandora English Facebook page where the party's happening of this auction. Just tell us about the auction, Tara.
Right. So earlier this year, a lot of you would be aware that there were some pretty terrible fires in Australia, and I'm sorry to any of you who are quite badly impacted by that. The house I'm in right now, actually, it's our only house in the world, and it nearly burnt down. And back in January, I was involved with the Authors for Fieries auctions. So with that same idea, what I've done just as an individual author is I'd like to try to raise some money for people who are doing it pretty tough at the moment with lockdown and COVID-19. It's affected all of us, but not equally. Some people are doing it particularly hard right now. They don't have the supports they need. They don't have somewhere safe to go. So this is my way of trying to help just a little bit where possible. I only have one set of these books here with me in lockdown, but I'm able to personally autograph this set of books and also give you the pin that I bought when I was in New York researching the Cobra Queen, like the photo you saw earlier. And I'm going to give that to whoever is the highest bidder. As the bidder, you get to decide who is going to benefit from your donation. So all you need to do is tell me in Australian dollars what your bid amount is. You can put it in the comments. And who you want that to go to. So in other words, what your pledge is. At the moment, the highest bid when I checked, like just before our session, was from Melanie, who's bidding $680 in Australian dollars to Young Care, which helps people in Australia who are young and who have high needs disabilities. And they really do need a lot of extra support right now, particularly with what's going on. So that is an excellent choice for a nonprofit. But again, you get to choose. So if you join in the bidding, I will welcome that. Well, I've only got one set of these books, so I'm hoping to, you know, to be able to help people with this, and your generosity is what's needed to make that happen. So anyone can participate. I'll send this set of books anywhere in the world. And if you have any questions as well, you can feel free to ask me on any of my social media channels and I'll get back to you.
Yeah, so we've got the Facebook page at the bottom of the screen there, so head on over there to check that out. But before we start wrapping up and I come back to Tara to ask her top three tips for aspiring writers, I just want to remind everyone that if you're interested in writing, then make sure that you head over to the Australian Writers Centre website, which is at the bottom of the screen, writerscentre.com.au. There's a bunch of courses that you might find interesting if you're a beginner. There's creative writing stage one. But if you want to get into more genre stuff, like Tara, there's fantasy, science fiction and more, and also crime and thriller writing. But Tara, let's come back to you. By the way, I've put Tara's URL at the bottom of the screen as well, so check out her website. What are your top three tips for aspiring authors who want to be in a position where you are one day, where, you know, they're being choked out, set on fire, writing lots of books?
Those things are optional. I should specify you don't necessarily need to be choked out in order to be a successful writer. In fact, I'd recommend that you don't, but that's just me. First of all, I would say join a writers group. So get involved with the Writers' Centre. I think what Valerie has been doing and what the Australian Writers' Centre is doing is excellent and is exactly the sort of support that a lot of authors, particularly aspiring authors, need and can benefit from. So I did online writing courses. I joined writers groups. I did all of that right at the beginning, and I think that really did help me. Another thing you really need to do is read. So any good writer needs to read. Make sure you read books. Otherwise, why do you want to write one? I always find it a bit funny when people imagine that they can just sort of write a book and it's going to go out there and everyone's going to read it, but they don't actually read other people's work and they don't know what's out there. I imagine if you're watching this, you're probably a bibliophile like I am. You love books, you love reading, and reading is that kind of magic that takes us anywhere. It's the magic... the magic machine of paper and imagination that can really transport us anywhere, particularly during lockdown, really, really valuable. So make sure you read books. And number three is write. I mean, really, Right. You can worry about it. You can be anxious about it. You can think about it. You can listen to podcasts on it. You should do all those things, but make sure ultimately that you do the writing. Don't write it right. Write it and then make it right later. So in other words, don't get yourself tied up in knots about every single word you're going to write before you put them down. Otherwise, you're probably never going to write. You're certainly not going to get through an entire book. So give yourself the freedom to make mistakes. Know that you're going to have to go back and edit it many times over. And just start writing today. If there's anything that's going to teach you to be a writer, it's actually writing.
Great advice. And thank you so much, Tara. And thank you to everybody who's joined us. There's lots of comments thanking you, Tara. So, big shout out to everyone who joined. Really appreciate it. And I have no doubt that we're going to have many more books from Tara. And thank you so much for joining us today and for joining us, everyone.
Well, thank you so much, Valerie, and thank you for making this particular thing available for authors, because, of course, none of us can do live events, and I've managed to put a book out during a pandemic. So I really
absolutely
appreciate the support and you know, the support for the Cobra Queen.
Get this book, everyone. Okay, signing off now.
Happy writing, everyone.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our 8-week course, Novel Writing Essentials, focuses on getting your manuscript off to the best possible start. Whether you've already started your opening chapters or just have a story idea, this course will help you shape the beginning of your novel through weekly lessons and workshopping in a supportive online environment. In doing so, you'll avoid potential mistakes down the track and meet the course goal of getting your first 20,000 words of your novel in the bag. You'll also enjoy the convenience of learning online with your very own tutor and classmates providing direct feedback on your writing. You can find out more at writerscentre.com.au/novel essentials. That's writerscentre.com.au/novel essentials.
There you go. It's always great to have a chat to Tara.
Yeah, she's, well, you know, I love the question and answer aspect too, because then you get to find out exactly what people really want to know. And the thing is with question and answer is that, you know, if you're thinking of a question, chances are someone else is also thinking of that question and probably too shy to ask. So, you know, I think they're great.
Yep, definitely. All right, so what are you doing in the coming week, Al?
Oh, what am I doing? That's a great question. See, I have no answer for it. Hopefully writing stuff. Well, I have to get those resources and things finished that I was talking about. Oh, I'm still working, you know, behind the scenes very hard on my website redesign. So I'm really hoping that might be ready to go soon as well. So that's been interesting. Like the biggest difficulty with that for me has been, it's not so much the look of it, which is, you know, over the years I've been incredibly lucky because I think the design of my website, you know, from a look perspective has always been really great. But it's more about the organization of it. And you realize, you know, once you've got a site that is basically over 10 years old and a blog that has been going for 10 years, you have an enormous amount of stuff.
Yep.
An enormous amount of stuff. So I'm, you know, it's the organization and the navigation of that enormous amount of stuff that has caused the most headaches behind the scenes,
right.
Just so you know. Yeah.
Good luck with it.
Thanks for that. And you, what are you doing?
Well, as you know, I am really occupied at the moment painting the portrait of Tim Cahill.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Let's just take a moment to say how good was the portrait. I received a portrait out of the blue from Mick Elliott of myself, a toon portrait with Procrasty Pup in it.
So
and the first question someone said was, why is Val not doing portraits of you, Al? And I'm like, well, that's a very, very good question. Like, why is she doing Tim Cahill and not doing me? I don't know. So thanks, big thank you to Mick Elliott for my portrait. I hope Tim's as happy with yours as I was with Mick's.
I will do your portrait one day.
You're going to do me as a block print or something? Turn me into a fabric. I've always wanted to be a fabric. I can be Materiel.
Oh my God.
I'm making mum jokes. It's time to go.
Oh no. All right. Where do we find you online, Al?
Oh, no, I just gazumped you. You're working, you're very important. Tell us about your project.
Well, there's not much to tell. I'm just in the middle of it.
I didn't mean to hijack you.
No, there's not much to tell. I'm in the middle of it and making slow but steady progress. Yeah, it's fun.
But it's for genes and it's very important.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yes, come on.
I will let everyone know when it's when the big reveal is, because it is for genes Day. So I'm donating my time. Tim has donated his participation and also his signed genes. For those of you who don't know Tim Cahill, he is not only a Socceroo and one of the most successful soccer players in the world, he's the highest ever scoring goal scorer in Australia, for Australia. He's also written children's books, and he runs football academies now, and he's an all-round fab guy. One of the things I've done, because I have, as you know, Al, read his bio, I've extracted sort of bits of his bio that I have found really inspiring and pasted them up around the portrait, just so that, you know, some of that ethos can potentially infuse in what I am painting. And fun fact, hot tip, what you can do, and many people will already know this, but when you read, say, I've got the hard copy book, but I've also got the Kindle because I wanted to do what I'm about to say, is that you can highlight sections of the Kindle, which many people know, but you can then immediately press you can also annotate as well, which is great, but you can also immediately press a button which converts them to, you know, almost like social media quotes, but you don't have to use them for social media. You can just put them on your phone or whatever. But if you want to put them on social media, you can press another button and it'll immediately share on social media. So, yeah, really good function on Kindle, which not that many people use. But anyway, I will let everyone know when it's available, because it will be available for auction for Genes for Genes Day to raise money for the Children's Medical Research Institute. Okay. That's it.
Wow. Okay. I wonder if people are still with us, or if they just bounced out at the end of they've missed so much. See, if you don't stick with us all the way till the end, you never, ever know what you're going to miss out on, right?
Yes. All right. Where do we find you online now?
You will find me at alisontait.com, alisontait.com. You'll find me on Twitter at Al Tait, ALTAIT, and you'll find me on Facebook and Instagram at Alison Tait Writer. And you, Val, where do we find you?
You'll find me at Valerie Koo, that's KHOO, on Twitter and Instagram, and over at valeriekoo.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We look forward to chatting to you again next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writerscentre.com.au/podcast, or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writerscentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.